Here's a look at our top stories this hour. Palestinian schools in occupied East Al-Quds are to go on a one-day strike in protest at Israel's plan to impose its own textbooks on them. A Yemeni rights group says mines and cluster bombs left by the Saudi-led coalition have killed 108 civilians and injured over 200 others since April. Also, U.S. President Joe Biden reiterates his anti-China rhetoric, saying that American forces would defend Taiwan in the event of a Chinese invasion. Thank you for joining us. Palestinian schools in occupied Al-Quds will observe a day-long strike on Monday in protest against Israel's attempts to impose distorted textbooks. The Palestinian National and Islamic Forces, a coalition of political factions, has called for the strike. It says the walkout is aimed at reaffirming the right of the Palestinian children to be taught their own curriculum, not the distorted one. The group also called on international institutions to press the regime not to interfere in the affairs of the Palestinian schools. On Saturday, parents and students held protests in several neighborhoods against Israel's attempts to prevent schools from teaching the official Palestinian textbooks. They decided, or they decried, Israel's disregard of their rights and chanted slogans such as "No to the distorted curriculum" and "No to Judaization education." The Palestinians say the regime is trying to deny students the right to learn their own history and culture. Yemeni people have been enduring years-long sufferings of Saudi-led aggression, and since the start of a fragile truce, hundreds of more civilians have fallen victim to planted mines or leftover cluster bombs. The Yemeni Executive Mine Action Center confirmed that mines, cluster bombs, and other explosive remnants used by the coalition have killed 108 civilians and injured 216 others. According to the center, the number of casualties has increased because the explosive remnants are found in large swaths of the country. It also attributed the increase to the return of the displaced Yemenis to those affected areas. The center says it needs mine detectors and other essential equipment to dispose of the planted mines and cluster bombs. The UN-backed truce in Yemen came into effect in April and was extended until early October. Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is no longer expected to attend Queen Elizabeth's funeral. A British Foreign Office source said the change in plans was made by Saudi Arabia without mentioning any reason. The British government faced a barrage of criticism for inviting the Saudi Crown Prince to attend the Queen's funeral. The criticism mainly centered around bin Salman's role in the murder and dismemberment of dissident Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. His fiancée has called for bin Salman to be arrested for murder when he arrived in London. A number of rights campaigners also cited excessive domestic repression and Saudi Arabia's deadly war against Yemen. They said the occasion would give bin Salman another chance to whitewash his human rights record. According to sources, another Saudi prince will represent the kingdom at the funeral. Earlier, we spoke to our London correspondent, Amina Taylor. She doesn't rule out the Saudi crown prince showing up for the Queen's funeral, despite reports to the contrary. Have a listen.
You know, for me, this is a very, what do they say? It kind of smells like three-day-old fish, this particular decision. Because just earlier on Press TV, we were discussing this very issue about just how horrible the optics were for a man who, inside his very own cabal, would have ordered the brutal execution of a dissident journalist inside the Saudi consulate in another country. So let's just look at the audacity of that, just as for starters. So whomever, wherever this decision came from, whether or not the palace could see that the optics were not good and perhaps had a word, perhaps MBS himself would have seen that there were just too many people who now knew where he was going to be, what that meant in terms of the focus being on the most appalling aspects of his regime, or even the British government, who might have had a word to say, listen, we'd love you to come, but politically it's a rough time right now. Why don't you just send someone in? Or this is a big smokescreen and the man will fly in on his private jet and we'll see him on on Monday, sitting front and center, and then he'll fly off. Because these things are about PR, catching your opponents off guard, trying to upset just how people think things might be happening, and then spring in a fast one. So Kaveh, I personally would not be surprised if tomorrow we saw him show up, because this is just, it's curious. It's a curious decision at this point.
The U.S. president has reiterated Washington's support for Taiwan despite repeated warnings from China not to interfere in the island's affairs. Joe Biden made the remark while responding to a question during an interview with a U.S. broadcaster. Have a listen.
So unlike Ukraine, to be clear, sir, U.S. forces, U.S. men and women, would defend Taiwan in the event of a Chinese invasion.
Yes.
Biden also talked about the One China policy, saying that the U.S. is not encouraging Taiwan's independence. Biden, however, said American forces would defend the island in case of what he called an unprecedented attack. His comments come amid heightened tensions with China. The two big economies have been on the collision course ever since a controversial visit by U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and other American politicians to Taiwan last month. Beijing considers Taiwan as part of its territory and has conducted unprecedented military drills around the island in reaction to growing nexus between Washington and Taipei. The Biden administration has also announced more than $1 billion in new arms sales to Taiwan. The United States is heaping up pressure on Russia on all fronts, from economic sanctions to diplomatic restrictions, but the White House has now gone a step further by telling South Africa not to associate with Russia at all. The South African president has hit back, saying it is not for Washington to decide who his country can or cannot do business with. The move may further alienate the U.S. when it comes to Africa as a whole.
On the surface, this is legislation that the U.S. is passing through Congress to, in short, stop African countries from associating with Russia, especially when it comes to business activities. But looking deeper, this is what many call the U.S. bullying other countries into submission. That is how the South African president is viewing this, urging the U.S. to not punish African nations by pressuring them to cut ties with Moscow. Cyril Ramaphosa realizes the dangers behind this legislation. You said that this measure will harm Africa and marginalize the continent. We should not be told by anyone who we can associate with. When it comes to Russia, many African countries feel the same. For example, when a UN voting took place for sanctions to be imposed on Russia, 17 African countries abstained from the UN vote. The U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, had to come out and defend U.S. interests in Africa, stating that U.S. intentions are not to dictate what African nations should do.
Too often, African nations have been treated as instruments of other nations' progress rather than the authors of their own. Time and again, they have been told to pick a side in great power contests that feel far removed from daily struggles of their people. The United States will not dictate Africa's choices. Neither should anyone else.
The source of this aggressive U.S. legislation dates back years ago. During the tenure of the former U.S. President Donald Trump, the U.S. unveiled a new Africa policy to counter what it called predatory Russia and China. This was unveiled by the former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton, who said that the U.S. was losing ground to China and Russia.
The predatory practices pursued by China and Russia stunt economic growth in Africa, threaten the financial independence of African nations, inhibit opportunities for U.S. investment, interfere with U.S. military operations, and pose a significant threat to U.S. national security interests.
Yet Bolton was not forthright in the U.S. policy on Africa. He failed to mention that the U.S. had limited resources to compete with the tens of billions of dollars that China was pouring into Africa. And on the predatory practices of China and Russia that set up debt traps, that just didn't hold ground. Take this piece of news, the fact that China canceled 23 loans to African countries. This silenced the critics that accused Beijing of practicing debt trap diplomacy, that it deliberately lent money to countries that it knows cannot repay the money, with the goal of increasing its political leverage. Meanwhile, the U.S. has fallen out of favor with many African countries. One survey found that 76% of young Africans named China as the foreign power with a positive influence on their lives. When it comes to Russia, the U.S. has accused it of selling arms in exchange for votes at the U.N. Those votes, he added, helped keep strongmen in power, undermined peace and security, and ran counter to the best interests of the African people. Well, if that is the case, then what about the U.S. keeping strongmen in power in monarchies in the Persian Gulf, regimes like Saudi Arabia or Bahrain?
The UK's Prime Minister is under pressure over an economic crisis exacerbated by soaring energy prices as warnings are issued of mass bankruptcies across the country. Liz Truss has unveiled a sweeping package of support for Britons facing soaring energy bills, but much of its detail has remained unpublished. Now, media reports say leading UK business organisations are warning of dire consequences if they continue to be left in limbo over the level of government support. They asked government ministers to show clarity on what help the government could offer them with their energy bills. Experts say many businesses have seen their energy costs skyrocket by 300% compared with last year, putting their future at risk. That's as inflation has hit heights not seen for 30 years, while the pound has sunk to a 37-year low. Thousands of Moldovans have hit the streets of the capital, Chisinau, to protest their government's policies to tackle high inflation and fuel prices. The demonstrators chanted slogans against officials and demanded the resignation of pro-Western President Maia Sandu and her government. It was the largest protest in the tiny ex-Soviet state since Sandu was elected in a landslide victory in 2020 on pledges to root out corruption. But she stands accused of causing an economic crisis. Meanwhile, she has promised to secure membership of the European Union, which has provided significant amounts of aid to the country. Hurricane Fiona has made landfall in Puerto Rico, knocking out all power and threatening to cause catastrophic flooding in a U.S. island territory. Packing winds of 140 kilometers per hour, Fiona is forecast to strengthen further in the next 48 hours as it sweeps across Puerto Rico and the Dominican Republic before heading north into the open waters of the Atlantic. Weather forecasts predict life-threatening flash flooding of streams, highways, and streets, as well as urban, low-lying, and poorly drained areas. Residents have been asked not to leave their homes and go to shelters if they are in areas prone to landslides and flooding. A state of emergency has been declared in Puerto Rico. Turkish Muslims gather in Istanbul to commemorate Arbaeen, which marks 40 days since the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein. Hundreds of mourners took to the streets of Turkey's biggest city to honor the occasion. Muslims in other countries marked the religious event on Saturday. Millions also converged on Iraq's holy city of Karbala, where Imam Hussein's shrine is located. Arbaeen is the largest annual religious congregation in the world. It marks 40 days after Ashura, when Imam Hussein and his companions were martyred during the Battle of Karbala in 680 AD. Arbaeen has been observed across Pakistan as well. Our correspondent Mama Turi has more from Karachi.
Miles covered on foot, mourners walked from their homes all the way to the city center in Karachi to join the main procession to show their love for Imam Hussein, the third Shia Imam.
Mourners have gathered here to commemorate the 40th day after the anniversary of Imam Hussein's martyrdom, and to show their respect for a man who sacrificed his life but did not pledge allegiance to the tyrant of his time, Yazid.
The mourners chanted, "Stand like Hussein against Yazid of your time."
People, you are looking there, there are a large amount of people here. People love Imam Hussein. This is the day which the family of Imam Hussein came from Sham to Karbala.
It's a lesson for many because his sacrifices for Islam and what he has done is something we should remember for all of our lives.
Abu Abdullah sacrificed for the Islam, for the people of Islam, for the people of the world, for the peace, for the humanity, for the justice.
The mourners recited elegies to remember the hardships of Prophet's grandson and the tragedy of Karbala, and protest against tyrants of the time.
We are here to tell the oppressors that we are not a minority. We are a majority here. And we always prove them wrong. Every year in Urbain, every year at this day, we prove them wrong that we are a minority. We are the biggest majority in the world, and we will stay the biggest majority.
Imam Hussein alayhi salam sacrificed his life and his family for this save the Islam, the message of Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, and become the voice of the voiceless people of humanity.
It is still relevant because it was such a great sacrifice on his part, because he sacrificed his family, his children, for the sake of our religion, for the sake of Allah. So for that reason, it is really relevant to us.
Those who participated in the mourning ceremonies say they are inspired by Imam Hussein's philosophy of freedom. His devotees and die-hard followers believe his legacy will remain a ray of hope for ages to come. Until then, millions across the globe will keep flocking Karbala to refresh their allegiance with their Imam. Muhammad Turi, Karachi.
Now our correspondent in Kabul, Abdullah Mirzada, reports on how Arbaeen has been commemorated in Afghanistan.
People across Afghanistan are commemorating the 40th day after the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, known as Arbaeen. People gather in mosques on this day and hold mourning ceremonies to pledge their loyalty to Imam Hussein and remember his legacy, which is resistance against arrogance and oppression.
Mourning gatherings in mosques and other places is not merely an emotional act, but it is a mixture of human values. People gather to raise their awareness and passion for righteousness, which is also the legacy of Imam Hussein.
On Arbaeen, the poor, as well as those who attend the mourning ceremonies, are fed for free. The march has now decreased due to the Taliban's new security measures to prevent attacks on mourners by extremist groups. The love for Imam Hussein, however, is growing day by day.
Not only the threats cannot affect such gatherings in a negative way, but oppositely, the enthusiasm for holding such events is growing day by day. Security threats cannot prevent such holdings.
Imam Hussein's movement does not belong to Muslims, but to all humanity. The lesson he taught is also for humanity. He taught all of us not to give in to arrogance.
Imam Hussein and his companions were martyred nearly 1400 years ago after they refused to pay allegiance to Yazid, the tyrant of the time. Those who participate in Arbaeen ceremonies believe that marking the day would help preserve the legacy of Imam Hussein, who sacrificed everything for the sake of Islam.
People in Afghanistan, like the rest of Shia Muslims, mark Arbaeen by doing religious activities to pledge their allegiance to Imam Hussein. They say they would not follow the arrogant, as did not Imam Hussein. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
That's a wrap for this hour's World News. Thank you for your company.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In the U.S., Senator Lindsey Graham's 15-week abortion ban bill is the first of likely many federal attempts at restricting abortion nationally. Please stay with us for more. Details of the story are given in the website salon.com. In his concurrence in Dobbs v. Jackson, Women's Health, the Supreme Court decision that overturned Roe v. Wade, Justice Brett Kavanaugh went to great pains to reassure Americans that their ability to get an abortion is not under threat. He wrote, "The court's decision today does not outlaw abortion throughout the United States." While he briefly mentions that Congress can always pass a national ban, he largely skates by that possibility to focus on how Dobbs technically does not prevent the numerous states that readily allow abortion from continuing to readily allow abortion. Implicit in Supreme Court Justice Kavanaugh's argument was an assumption that so long as middle and upper class people feel they will always have access, by and large they will not care if people who are too constrained by poverty to travel are forced into unwanted childbirth. But Kavanaugh also underestimated how determined the Christian right, through the Republican Party, is to make sure that no one outside of the very wealthy who can travel out of the country has access to abortion. As soon as it became clear that pro-choice activists were having real success protecting abortion rights in some states, and not just in blue states, but places like Kansas and Minnesota, anti-choice activists started to strategize about how to prevent people from getting abortions by simply hopping in a car or on a plane. Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican, South Carolina, joined that process on Tuesday, 13th of September, unveiling what will no doubt be the first in a series of Republican bills meant to restrict abortion on a national scale. He introduced the Protecting Pain-Capable Unborn Children from Late-Term Abortions Act, a title which accomplishes the remarkable feat of including at least two lives. First, the bill would ban abortions at 15 weeks, which is approximately 13 weeks after fertilization, and 11 weeks after the first missed period. No respectable doctor would call that a late-term abortion. Second, as the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists notes, the science conclusively establishes that a human fetus does not have the capacity to experience pain until after at least 24 or 25 weeks. The idea that a fetus feels pain at 15 weeks comes straight from anti-abortion propaganda and not science. Instead, the machinations behind this bill suggest that the 15-week cutoff is not about any sincere concern about pain, but a political gambit meant to move along the process of eventually banning abortion nationwide, while not intensifying the already significant voter backlash against the Republicans over this issue. Right now, Republicans are the ones who are viewed by most voters as the extremists. Republicans want to reframe this issue. Their strategy to do so involves blatant lying. Republicans repeatedly make the risible and flat-out false accusations that the pre-Dobbs legal structure allowed abortion up until the time of delivery. During the press conference announcing this bill, Senator Lindsey Graham repeated the lie, accusing Senate Democrats of wanting allow abortions up to the moment of birth. As the Kaiser Family Foundation notes, however, these scenarios do not occur, nor are they legal, in the United States. Indeed, 88% of abortions are in the first 12 weeks, and those after 21 weeks are about 1% of abortions. Britain's Guardian newspaper covers the same story from a different angle. Senator Lindsey Graham proposed legislation on Tuesday, 13th of September, for a nationwide 15-week abortion ban, a politically risky strategy as a backlash grows to the US Supreme Court ruling earlier this summer overturning federal protections for the procedure. Opinion poll shows that 57% of the American public disapprove of the court's June reversal of the 1973 Roe v. Wade ruling, guaranteeing access to abortion, and 62% of the American public say the procedure should be legal in all or most cases. The proposal by Senator Graham, a hardline South Carolina Republican, will be called the Protecting Pain-Capable Unborn Children from Late-Term Abortions Act. It stands almost no chance of becoming law, but is seen by analysts as an attempt to frame the discussion around abortion with fewer than 60 days to go until midterm elections in November. The White House and top Democrats promptly decried Senator Graham's efforts. Today, Senator Graham introduced a national ban on abortion which would strip away women's rights in all 50 states. This bill is wildly out of step with what the American public wants and believes, White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre said in a statement. Jean-Pierre added, while President Biden and Vice President Harris are focused on historic passage of Inflation Reduction Act to reduce the cost of prescription drugs, healthcare, and energy, and to take unprecedented action to address climate change, Republicans in Congress are focused on taking rights away from millions of American women. Karine Jean-Pierre said the Biden administration and Democrats in Congress are committed to restoring the protections of Roe v. Wade. Republicans in states, including South Carolina, have seen recent efforts to introduce abortion bans falter, and Democrats are certain to use Senator Graham's push to fire up their base and repeat earlier warnings that their opponent's agenda has always been the pursuit of outlawing abortion nationally. Previous versions of Senator Lindsey Graham's bill have outlawed abortion after 20 weeks of pregnancy, but at a press conference on Tuesday, he was unveiling a proposed ban that takes effect after 15 weeks, an attempt to align federal law with Florida. Senator Lindsey Graham's earlier proposal contained exceptions for rape, incest, and to protect the life of the mother, which the Florida law does not. The Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, added to her party's protest, calling Senator Graham's proposal the latest, clearest signal of extreme MAGA Republicans' intent to criminalize women's health freedom in all 50 states and arrest doctors for providing basic health care. President Joe Biden has recently toughened his language as the midterm elections approach and Republicans put forward many right-wing candidates, decrying the so-called MAGA Republican, semi-fascist and Trumpies.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and let us reflect upon what Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, told a person who said, favours are worthless if they're done to other than those who seem to deserve them. No, this is inaccurate. Favors should be like the heavy rain that covers both the pious and the sinful.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, justice in social life. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of justice in the social life in the Islamic teachings and Islamic lifestyle. When we look at the Islamic teachings, we see that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has ordered us to be just in our life, and especially in our social life, when we are socializing with others, we must observe the justice. It is a very clear verse of Quran in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, chapter 16, verse 90, Allah has said, "Inna Allah ya'muru bil adli wal ihsan." Allah has ordered, ya'muru, He has ordered you, bil adli wal ihsan, to have the justice and be kind with the people. And this is what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said. Islam pays attention to the topic of justice, and if we do not have justice in our life, we cannot have a healthy social life, we cannot have a healthy environment in our society, we cannot have a peaceful and secure society around us. And it is very necessary in the Islamic teachings, according to the Islamic teachings, that we must observe the justice. And this means that in all aspects of our life, when we are socializing with the people, with our neighbors, with the people at the job, I don't know, with the people whom we live, with the people in the same city or same country, or people from other races, we must observe justice and be fair with everyone in our life and deal everyone with fairness and justice and be kind to them, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of justice and kindness in the Islamic lifestyle. And we said that it is necessary to observe justice in the social life, because when we are living a social life, we must observe justice. And it is very important, because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala also has ordered us to observe justice in our daily life. And if we want to have a secure and peaceful life, a peaceful society, a secure society, we must observe justice. And wherever there is injustice, we must raise our voice against it. Today, if we see oppression in the society, today, if we see injustice in the society, today, if we see that there are some people who are making profit for themselves and they're not taking care of others in the society, it is just because that people have forgotten the duty towards the others. And if we remember our duties, our responsibilities towards the society, towards the other, and how to boost the society, how to boost people, how to help needy people, how to bring them up in order to have a good life, if we forget all these things, then obviously we will see oppression, we will see more people getting oppressed by others, we see different races in the society. But if we have a justful life, if we have a life in which we are observing the social justice, then there is no race, there is no color, there is no rich and poor. Everyone is equal, and Islam teaches us that, because when we stand up in the prayer, when we stand in a line in the mosque in order to pray five-time prayers, we see that everyone is standing in the same line. Everyone is performing the prayers in the same way without any differentiation. Inshallah, we must observe the justice. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
England's Paradise Wildlife Park
welcomes its new guest, an endangered red panda cob. The mother, Tilly, gave birth to the cob just 1 month after she lost her breeding partner, Nampang. Experts say Tilly had been under a breeding project for 4 years. The cob has been named Little Red, and his birth is being celebrated as a, quote, symbol of hope. Red pandas are classed as an endangered species and are on the red list of the International Union for Conservation of Nature. The bushy-tailed bamboo munchers dwell in high-altitude Asian forests, and their population is now fewer than 2,500. Chinese astronauts are celebrating their first ever mid-autumn festival in outer space while sharing their otherworldly experience with people on Earth. The crew had a close-up view of the moon from China's Tiangong space station and their third month in space. On the occasion, the ground crew organized a series of celebrations, including a family reunion for the astronauts. The ground crew also prepared elaborate food packages that had been prepared before the launch of the spacecraft. Typically, the traditional festival is kicked off by the first viewing of the full moon on the 15th day of the eighth month of the lunar calendar. Despite being able to see the moon rise and set 16 times a day, the astronauts say the moon is special on this occasion. Forestry authorities in southwestern China have opened a new canteen for wild Asian elephants in a bid to stop them wandering into villages. The canteen in Yunnan province provides the animals with attractive and nutritious meals while exploring man-animal harmonious coexistence. During these years, the province has explored multiple ways to reduce the encounters between humans and elephants and try to keep the animals away from farmers' crops. There are now approximately 1,400 hectares of dining halls for elephants, with many expanding from 100 to 240, such as corn, rice and sugarcane. They are planted on a large scale and within easy reach of the elephants. The location of such canteens is extremely selective, usually away from villages and major roads, and the chefs are locals. Most of the time, you have to visit an exhibition to see art. But what if art comes to see you instead? Well, a group of artists in Mali have created a floating art venue that will travel up and down the River Niger. It's called the Pirogue du Zem, which is a floating vessel. It's designed to host plays, exhibitions, dance shows, and so much more. The idea is to make art a movable feast that is no longer restricted to fixed venues in cities and accessible to all people. The project was created by a local artist and architect who had a vision to bring art to the masses. The vessel is 20 meters long and 6 meters wide, built with storage and enough space for exhibition. Government officials say the floating venue will showcase Mali's talents and creativity while attracting tourists.
Colombia is known for its tourist attractions and is full of breathtaking natural sights such as beaches, mountains, deserts, and forests. The South American nation is also one of the few places that give tourists the chance to have an encounter with whales. Every year, from July to October, domestic and foreign tourists flock to Colombia's Pacific coast to catch a glimpse of humpback whales. The large animals reach the coast after traveling thousands of kilometers kilometers from Antarctica and southern Chile. But for visitors, there are strict rules to help preserve the area and the whales. Tourists are now being welcomed for whale watching after a two-year hiatus due to the coronavirus pandemic. This is also the time when humpback whales start their reproductive process. Art restoration requires intensive research and training and loads of skill. But imagine the anxiety while professionals embark on restoring rare paintings. Under careful supervision, French restorers are working to give back to 500-year-old paintings their former glory. They were rescued from a fire that engulfed the Notre-Dame Cathedral in Paris in 2019. These works date back from the 17th and early 18th century. The paintings, including 22 with large format, were temporarily stored in a warehouse and now being restored at an undisclosed location. The fire caused strictly no damage to the paintings, but they have accumulated thick layers of dirt and smoke on the surface after hanging in the cathedral for centuries. Some of the works also have paint loss due to overcleaning that restorers say need to be repaired elegantly.
Africa is taking back some of its greatest treasures stolen by the British back in the 19th century. The Horniman Museum in London has agreed to return the artifacts to Nigeria. These are 72 relics, which include 12 highly treasured brass plaques known as the Benin Bronzes. The bronzes are a group of several thousand metal plaques and sculptures that decorated the royal palace of the once mighty kingdom of Benin since the 16th century. These artifacts were looted from a region in modern-day Nigeria in a British military incursion. They later ended up in museums in Europe and the U.S. African countries have been fighting to recover works pillaged by explorers and colonizers as Western institutions grapple with the cultural legacy of colonialism.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Illegal hunting and hybridization with American crocodiles have for decades threatened their populations, with some species being on the verge of extinction. But there are some people who put their lives at risk to save the natural heritage. A Cuban researcher has released a baby crocodile that was confiscated from illegal hunters back into the wild. It was a happy moment for Etienne Perez, who went waist-deep in the dark water of Zapata Swamp to free Cuban crocs, the smallest known range of any living crocodile species. Cuban scientists were racing for quite some time to save the rarest crocodile. The government has protected virtually all of the vast swamp, widely considered to be the best preserved in the Caribbean. But the scientists say more efforts are needed to save the nature.
Releasing crocodiles seized from poachers is really impressive because we return the animal to a free life in the wild. In the case of the animals in the hatchery, we are trying to increase the historical range of the Cuban crocodile and, of course, increase the number of these individuals in the wild.
Cuban scientists estimate that around 4,000 crocodiles continue to live in the wild. But because the area they prefer within the wetland is relatively small, a climate-related disaster, increasingly common now globally, could wipe out the brunt of the population. They say illegal hunting for decades is also threatening crocodile populations.
A wide range of cutting-edge digital technology is grabbing the limelight at the 2022 China International Fair for Trade in Services, which is underway in Beijing. The exhibition is featuring a wide range of products, including artificial intelligence, virtual reality, metaverse, and 5G. Visitors can be seen taking virtual reality driving lessons and enjoying scenarios, including different road and weather conditions, wearing VR kits. It's the leading and largest comprehensive fair for trade and services in China. This year, an increasing number of traditional service companies are speeding up their transformations, resorting to smart technologies. The event has set up 9 thematic exhibitions, including cultural and tourism services, education and sports services, hygiene and health services, engineering, consulting, and environmental services. Foam is fun to play with, particularly for kids, but when it's mixed with art, it also becomes a grown-up matter. And that's what a German artist has done, creating a sea of rainbow-coloured foam as an interactive art piece and allowing the audience to enjoy themselves and become part of the art. Colours mixed by Stephanie Luning were turned into rainbow-hued foam cascading down the stairs. The performance was called Island of Foam, version 18. Excited children jumped in as soon as the bubbly sea reached the base of the stairs, delighted to be playing in the rainbow playground. The art piece is made up of largely of water and a food colouring. The artist says she loves working in public spaces and reaching a broad audience of all ages.
Because I like to be surprised by the result myself, and I like to work with this that you never know how it's going to turn out. You have the wind, the weather conditions, the locations, the audience. You never know how the people are going to respond and how the artwork turns out. And that's really what I like a lot, and also how to reach a broad audience.
However, Stephanie says there's tons of work behind all the fun, and cleaning up the mess can be hard. Interactive art is a form of art that achieves its purpose by involving the audience. The immersive art piece is part of the Greenwich and Docklands International Festival, an annual festival of performing arts and outdoor theatre. Have you ever heard of fighting nature with nature? Well, that's what the San Francisco metro system in the U.S. did to stop pigeons from overrunning the place. The station has hired a hawk as the new guard to patrol the area. Pac-Man is a 5-year-old Harris's hawk who has taken up the perch at the station. In terms of experience, he is pretty new, as he finished training only 9 months ago. The station recently renovated its building, installing netting and spikes to prevent pigeons from nesting. But these birds still seem to find their way to hang around. So with the Falconer Force, Ricky Ortiz and his hawk were hired this summer to keep the pigeons at bay.
So a typical day is we get here, we make our round, we start off down in the bottom inside the facility, making sure there's no pigeons hanging out in there. And then we work our way up here to the platforms and just check the ledges and the roof and make sure that they're not trying to sneak in on us, and keep them out. And he does a pretty good job of that.
The team patrols 3 days a week, and Pac-Man is allowed to swoop in and scare any pigeons sitting around. The Falconer says less than half of the pigeons they left after the first week of Pac-Man flying and establishing the territory. Commuters and station managers say they also noticed the difference. The Falconer says he usually keeps his feathery friend happy on the job by giving him snacks throughout the day. This also encourages the hawk not to feast on the pigeons and local rodents.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Former President Donald Trump's lawyers urge a judge to reject the Department of Justice's bid to resume its review of documents seized from Mar-a-Lago pending an appeal of the court ruling to appoint a special master. The FBI seized thousands of government records when it raided Mar-a-Lago in Florida, including many that bore high-level classification marks. The Department of Justice, the DOJ, has argued that a special master is unnecessary and could harm the government's national security interests in the criminal investigation. Stay with us for more. The Associated Press has covered this story. The Justice Department asked the Federal Appeals Court on Friday, 16th of September, to lift a judge's order that temporarily barred it from reviewing the batch of classified documents seized during an FBI search of former President Donald Trump's Florida home at Mar-a-Lago last month. The Department of Justice told the 11th Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals in Atlanta, Georgia, that the judge's hold, imposed last week, had impeded the government's effort to protect the nation's security and interfered with its investigation into the presence of top-secret information at Mar-a-Lago. It asked for a court to remove that order so work could resume and to hold the judge's directive forcing the department to provide the seized classified documents to an independent arbiter for his review. The government and the public would suffer irreparable harm absent a stay of the order, department lawyers wrote in their brief to the appeals court. U.S. District Judge Eileen Cannon's appointment of a so-called special master to review the documents and the resulting legal tussle it has caused appears certain to slow by weeks the department's investigation into the holding of classified documents at the Florida property after Donald Trump left the White House. The Justice Department has been investigating possible violations of multiple statutes, including under the Espionage Act, but it remains unclear whether Donald Trump, who has been laying the groundwork for a potential presidential run in 2024, or anyone else might be charged. The FBI says it took about 11,000 documents, including roughly 100 with classification markings found in a storage room and an office while serving a court-authorized search warrant at the home of Donald Trump on 8th of August. Weeks after the search, Trump lawyers asked the judge to appoint a special master to conduct an independent review of the rounds. U.S. District Judge Eileen Cannon granted the request last week, assigning a special master to review the records and weed out any that may be covered by claims of attorney-client or executive privilege. She directed the department to halt its use of the classified documents for investigative purposes until further court order or until the completion of the special master's work.